the reason it's so complicated and so difficult for a startup to sell into this is because, as I said way back, it's a complex web and IoT is new.
Welcome to the Industrial IoT Spotlight, your number one spot for insight from industrial IoT thought leaders who are transforming businesses today, with your host, Eric Walenza.
This is an episode of the Ventures in Industrial IoT series, brought to you by GE Ventures. In the series, we explore success factors and challenges in industrial IoT markets with CEOs, investors, and experts.
Welcome back to the Industrial IoT Spotlight. I'm joined today by Derek Keratin. Derek is founder of IoT Forum. He is also in wearing multiple hats. So Derek is also the managing director and principal analyst of the Keratin Group. He's the founder and chairman of Telecom Council of Silicon Valley, as well as the founder and chairman of Autotech Council. And Derek is also an advisor on both RCR Wireless News and MakesBridge Technology. Derek, the topic today is open ecosystems to support innovation in industrial IoT. From your background, you're the right man to be talking to. Before we dive into the topic, can you give a quick overview of yourself, and in particular, your role in these organizations and the background for why you decided to found these organizations and the value that they've created for you and then for the companies that participate?
Thank you, Eric. Good to be here. And thanks for the opportunity. First of all, I guess what we do here at those various organizations you mentioned, Telecom Council, Autotech Council, and the IoT Forum being my three main areas of focus, we try to build communities in Silicon Valley where we source local innovators and entrepreneurs and startups, and we kind of give a light screening to them. So we find good ideas as they're forming, and then we take them to the big players in those different marketplaces. So if it were the idea in the automotive space, we have a variety of members in the Autotech Council, like car makers, Ford, Mitsubishi, Toyota, Nissan, Peugeot, things like that. And we've filtered them good ideas in the automotive space. Same thing in the telecom space, where the larger companies, the network operators, the Ericssons, the Nokias, Orange, France Telecom, British Telecom, Docomo, you name it. We try to find innovations in Silicon Valley, in California, and bring them up more quickly. Our ambitions are to help these companies, both large and small, foster an ecosystem where innovation can reach the end customer faster and kind of bring the future and the benefits of the future to us a little more quickly. So we do that in those areas. And of course, lately we've been doing it in the IoT space. And the ambitions there are very similar. How do we get innovations out to the marketplace as quickly as possible?
Maybe then focusing on IoT Forum, how does this work in practice? The concept makes perfect sense. I think practice, much more complicated to effectively bring these companies together.
Right. And so, a lot of organizations that, claim to do stuff like we do it in a variety of different ways. And some of them are successful and some of them less so. What we tend to do is kind of an age-old technology. It's basically mashing people together. So what we want to do is get the right people in the room and then making it a dynamic in that room that gives them a reason to connect, engage, shake hands literally face-to-face as humans, and then maybe proceed on to the next level. The format and the structure, therefore, is we call them meetings, but other people might see that a bit as a mini conference. But think of a mini conference or a meeting of perhaps 100 people. And those people have all been focused along a topic line. So if it's in IoT, that's great. That's a little bit of a narrowing of Silicon Valley down to just the IoT people in the space. But then we might take it a level further and say, today we're talking about agricultural IoT. And so people specifically interested in that narrow sector would show up for that meeting. So already by having the people up and down the peninsula here in California, up and down the Bay Area, say, well, that's actually relevant to me. I'm going to go to that meeting. Now the people in the room are interesting. They're startups who have solutions that they want to sell into the marketplace, and they are buyers who are active in agricultural and the farmers and farm groups and cooperatives who are looking for interesting technologies in those spaces. And then we also have a host of middleware providers who say, great, well, we can provide analytics on top. And then we'll have some hardware people who say, I want to come there because I have some hardware, some sensors for ground moisture. So those people come into the room, they've been filtered by the content, by the topic, and we use our pretty big mail list to kind of get the word out that the meeting is happening. Once those 100 people in the room, this is not a huge meeting. It's a small meeting where the people are encouraged to kind of meet everybody there that day. Then we have your typical conference has people go up and do a 45-minute presentation and explain what they're showing. We like to compress that. People here in California are pretty rushed up in the Bay Area. And also what we want to do is we want to let people explain what they do and then get off the stage and go start networking. So our presentations are very short, between 7 and 10 minutes in our conference. And the great thing is, if you're interested in what the presenting company is saying, so maybe a startup is showing their new sensor that is mentioned, senses ground moisture for agriculture use. If you're interested, great. When that guy walks off the stage during break, you're going to exchange business cards and arrange a follow-up. If you're not interested, well, you lost 7 minutes. We're on to the next one. So that's the method of engagement. Long breaks and encouraging people to network during those breaks, and then giving the startups the opportunity to go up and kind of do their 7 minutes. So it's not like a random networking thing where you have to work the room. You're going to go up and get your brief window of time, pitch what you have, and then anybody who's interested in connecting with that because that sensor is of interest to them will join you at the break. And of course, we also do as an organization, we try to make sure if people say, hey, where'd that guy go? We'll walk people around the room and help them find that person. And if after the fact, they say, listen, I met everybody I needed except for that one guy from that soil moisture sensor, we'll help people connect after the fact as well. The essence of what we try to do is make those connections happen for the next follow-up meeting. So we deliver everything up to that first significant 1 hour meeting. So what we expect and what does happen after we provide kind of our engagement in the room we provide is those companies that are interested do have those 1 hour follow-up meetings. And in a number of cases, they actually follow on to have business relationships and contracts.
Follow up here. You're in a very savvy part of the world, a very tech savvy part of the world where I imagine even, you know, farmers are going to be quite comfortable with technology.
It's too tech savvy, of course, but go on. Meaning, and I mean that in a serious way, it's too tech savvy in the sense that often we build products that only we would like. But go on.
And so I can see how this would work. You know, I'm based in Shanghai, also an interesting part of the world. But if I try to explain, you know, an IoT solution to a farmer, there's going to be a significant understanding gap. To what extent are you wrestling with this? And how do you address this? How do you address the fact a lot of the technology that's coming to market is it's very complex. It's not only complex in the root technology, but it might also be looping, you know, 6 or 7 different technologies together into a system. So also complex from the system perspective. And then you have end users who are very traditional businesses. Do you play a role in this, or do you expect the vendors to, you know, basically figure out how to present their value?
I'm beautifully insulated from the fact that the farmers don't actually know anything about what's being built for them, and they have to focus on their farming. Oh, I'm nicely upstream where I'm connecting these technologists with these big companies that want to sell solutions to farmers. And that beautiful insulation is one of the biggest problems that Silicon Valley can have. So we try to avoid getting in a mindset of, I'll let somebody else worry about that. And in fact, we try to communicate that throughout our membership and as part of the discourse at our meetings whenever we have them, is we need to be thinking about selling through to the end customer. It's not enough for Silicon Valley. And I said this, we're in a very tech-savvy place, and that's one of our curses, as you were asking the question. We can keep building these products that maybe are great, but if you can't communicate the greatness to the end user, the product will fail. And then what's the global impact? What's the innovation impact on the world of products that were great but didn't go anywhere? It's still zilch. Doesn't matter how great it was in theory. So we like to step back and not just be, relish our insulation. I don't actually sit down and talk to farmers very often. I do need to think about those different markets. And so in my organizations, what we try to do is actually, as I said, bring a farming cooperative or a large agribusiness to some of our meetings to say, here's what agribusiness wants, and make sure that Silicon Valley is communicating directly with that end customer. Now, to be fair, it's pretty hard to get the actual end user in the room here in Silicon Valley. And so I mentioned farming cooperatives and I mentioned agribusinesses. You know, when you're talking about a small independent farmer, he's not flying up to Silicon Valley or Chicago or you know, in New York City or anywhere where there's a big conference to talk farm tech. You know, where is he getting his technology? He's getting it from his local vendors. And that's why when we do talk to the farmers, we talk to cooperatives because they are a little larger. They do have innovation officers and things like that that are out looking for the new technologies. And these will be kind of where the technologies first land and hit the ground. But so, you know, really, that's what you've touched on, one of the bigger challenges in IoT that we're noticing when we contrast it to the other markets we work in, like telecom and automotive. And that is the nature of supply chain in IoT. So I want to shift. I think that was my answer to that question. We need to be very conscious of the end user, but it's tough to get them to get on a plane and come to a conference to learn about the latest tech. Realistically, it doesn't happen. So how do you, how to get the message out? That you need to, let me end that first question. I kind of babbling here because it is switching topics, Eric, as we go into this. I think
looking more generally at the supply chain, then, you know, again, if we look at this also as a global ecosystem where you might have the sensors and a lot of the hardware being produced out of southern China, you have a lot of the software coming out of Silicon Valley, you have a lot of the intermediaries maybe in the Midwest, and this supply chain is it's complex and it's very immature.
Right. So I think one of the reasons I stumbled back there is because we're mixing two very important topics. One is, how do you communicate with the ultimate end user? And that's a big thing I honestly haven't got the answer for, but I'll share some thoughts later. But the one you're touching on that I do think I can open right now and deal with is how complex the ecosystem is here for business. And if I compare that to existing ecosystems like the automotive industry, and if you're a customer and you want to go buy a car, you know where to go. You go to a car dealer and you buy your car. So let's just use Ford as an example. You go to Ford dealership because that's what you want. Pick up a Mustang, they're good to go. Where did the dealer get the car? Well, the dealer knows where to go. They look upstream. It's Ford Motor Company. So they have an arrangement with Ford as a franchise operator, buy the cars from there. Where did Ford get the car? Well, they're car makers. So they're the final, you know, they assemble them and they're the ones that sell them, slap the brand on it. But it turns out they get the parts from a variety of tier one and tier two automotive suppliers. And they know who those suppliers are and they work with them on a regular basis. And then the parts and sensors that go into those elements, well, the tier one and tier two suppliers also have their suppliers and their raw materials, being steel, chemicals, things like that. Everybody up this value chain is kind of linear. Everybody knows where to look up the chain and where to look down the chain. Now, let's translate that and say, hey, does that work in the IoT? Well, IoT is a pretty new field, so it's not really hashed out like that. And it's not really that simple. And then also the additional problem, I don't think it ever will be, because in an IoT ecosystem, it is not this supply chain. It's very much a web where if you want to assemble a solution, if you're a customer, you're a farmer and say, I want to make my farm a smart farm. What do I have to do? Well, there's a variety of hardware like sensors you're going to have to buy from somewhere. You're going to have to get a services provider who maybe can install those for you, who's going to provide you analytics and computer systems to make sense of the data that's coming off of that. You might want to go to another vendor like a John Deere to buy equipment to leverage that information. And all of these things have to be integrated together. But you might say, well, I'm not a John Deere user. I actually use Mitsubishi tractor. Okay, so they got a different provider, but you still want to use the same smart solutions providers you have. You start to have this problem where you have to be cobbling together different solution providers to get the solution you want. And because of that complexity, it stunts the adoption of the market. If there's not a simple adoption process for the average user, the average farmer, they're going to look at this and say, this is too complex. I'll just stick with doing nothing for now until it gets simpler. So that's the nature of it. We have this complex web where you can pick different solutions from all kinds of different people. Taking it back to the car thing one more time, if you buy a Ford car, you don't really choose your radio. You get the radio that Ford provides. You know, you get the tires that Ford originally provides. You can obviously change those, but what you're buying is the solutions that Ford provided. But if you want to build an IoT solution, usually you have to pick all those different pieces and assemble them yourself. That's the situation we're in today in 2017. Now, how do we solve that, make life easier for the customers? It is one of the major questions that we face in the whole IoT ecosystem. If we don't make the solutions easier to implement and simpler to make the choices, people are going to get scared off and do nothing for a while. And only the most ambitious companies will start deploying IoT. And that's kind of who's doing it right now. I was at a conference where I talked about some of these subjects and I got a question from a guy who's in the plumbing industry. Turns out he's actually a private equity guy and he's buying a bunch of different plumbers and he's putting them together and wants to run them in a metropolitan area and have a lot of different plumbers under one brand. Let's just call it A1 Plumbing, you know, first in the phone book and things like that. He's saying, okay, as I aggregate these different small plumbers into one business, I want to leverage technologies that make this organization more efficient. And IoT seems like a pretty good technology. I've heard people talk about connecting each one of these plumbers' vans, having an inventory of which parts are in each of the van as part of the system so that, you know, this story is one plumber will go to repair a customer's problem in their house and say, oh, I don't have the part I need. Let me just launch into the system. And the system will tell him, hey, you know, the closest part is in Frank's van 5 miles away. Frank is 30 minutes from finishing his job. You know, do you wait for Frank or do you drive to Frank's van to get the part or do you drive 30 miles to the warehouse? And because you can now go 5 miles to get the part out of Frank's van and return to your job, there's an efficiency achieved by that plumbing company. So this VC, who the private equity guy who has learned about what IoT could do for him, says, that sounds great. How do I do it? I haven't got a clue where to start. And he said, I've come to this conference It's an IoT conference. I've met dozens of people, and I feel like I'm further away from knowing where to start than before I got here. Basically, he's blinded by the options. You know, look, you can use any of these 100 different sensor companies, any of these 30 different vehicle tracking solutions, any of these 30 different Salesforce automation and analytics platforms and inventorying platforms. And you can use these 10 different system integrators. And AT&T wants to talk to you about connectivity solutions, but so does T-Mobile and Verizon and Sprint. And also some MVNOs like Aris want to talk to you about connectivity for your vans. It goes on and on and on. So this guy, who was keen on the subject, went to a conference and, as I said, grew more and more confused and more reticent to launch into any effort, because basically what he would have is he has the paradox of choice, where there's so many choices that he'll feel like any choice he makes is bound to be not the best choice, and therefore he might be frozen in his tracks. And essentially, when you have that many options, there's no way you can investigate them all, and the only thing you can be certain of is the choice you made is probably not the best one. And that's a fact. That's just a statistical fact that you probably didn't make the best choice. So what we do is, as humans, we let the perfect be the enemy of the good enough. And instead of building a good enough solution that you can just go out and build today, we want to build the perfect solution so that our CEOs, our bosses don't say, hey, why didn't you use X vendor? I heard they're better. And like, oh man, I didn't even look at that. So this particular plumber, real story, a real guy that came up to me, and he asked me as I was on a panel, and then we had a further discussion after we got off the stage. He truly wanted to know, and he is representative of so many other farmers, plumbers, factory workers, oil patch companies, like truly wanted to know, where do I start? And so I had some answers to him that I'd like to share with you on the podcast here. But I think as an industry, we have to kind of share these answers with all of our customers out there. So the where do I start question, I think the answer has to be, once again, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good. What you need to do is build a good solution and get out there and start leveraging it, because there's ROI available. And you can iteratively improve on it. Yes, it's hard to swap out entire components, but turns out if you do something now, you'll have 5 years of learning and benefiting from that system. And then you can reiterate in 5 years and say, okay, do we rip out what we got or do we build on it, before you kind of double down and do another medium-term reinvestment. How do you build that five-year plan for connecting your plumber shop, for example, to IoT? Well, as the guy said, he doesn't know where to start. So I said, you got to just pick a starting position. You got to say, what's really important to me? The connectivity, do I need my vans to be connected 100% of the time? Then start with a carrier who can argue for perfect connectivity. Is it the analytics? Do you just want the best analytics? Start there. So find an analytics company that says, we got a good analytics platform that works for services firms like plumbers. So shop just that. Don't shop everything, sensors, tracking device. Just start with what's important to you. Analytics, good. So you're going to pick an analytics firm and go with them and say, okay, when you talk to that firm, you're going to ask, now that I like you for my analytics, who do you recommend for connectivity? Who do you recommend for vehicle tracking? Who do you recommend for sensors? Do you integrate with Salesforce.com for my sales call? So start with that one firm and then find the recommended partners up and down the line. And what you build out of this complicated web is almost impossible for somebody to solve. What you build, at least, is a virtual chain, right? You simplify it. You've picked the first, that vendor, which in this case is analytics, and you've asked them, what's your chain up and down? Or I can build something that you're telling me I know is compatible and we'll work together at least, and I can get that as a starting position. And then you, as I said, you can take their advice, or you can say, I have heard that Verizon might have better coverage in my region than Sprint, so I'm going to swap that element out, and hopefully they can figure that in. But I'm basically going to take this recommended solution up and down. And that's a good way to you have to nail something down as a starting point. And that's kind of my advice to the plumber. But my advice to our industry and us is, we've got to have these suggested solutions in place so that if somebody comes to you, you can say, yes, I can sell you the sensors. I'm a sensor company, but I can also suggest who we connect with. What network tools connect well with us, which modems work well with my solution, which analytics solutions people are layering on top and find are good partners. So you have these recommended partners up and down. None of it mandatory, but if somebody comes and says, I would like a turnkey solution, you're able to offer something akin to a turnkey solution. So that's my recommendation for industry. And then... hopefully we get over this huge educational hump. But as I said, my expectation is that at no point in the future does IoT become as simple as the automotive industry, for example, which, by the way, isn't a simple industry, simplified it down. But IoT will always be even more complicated than that.
Great answer. I think this is something that every company does need to, one, internalize, but also communicate to their customers and their partners. One of the things that, you know, we interact a lot with startups at IoT One, and many companies, even as they progress towards the growth phase, have kind of an open horizon for what industries and what needs they serve. So you ask them, do you serve the oil and gas industry? Yes, we do. Okay, what reference customers do you have? Well, we don't have any yet. But our technology is very applicable to oil and gas, right? So everybody has this, or many companies have this perception that their technology is very horizontal, which it might be technically, but if they're not able to focus on a specific customer and say, this is the customer that we're serving, even though many other companies could potentially use our technology, it becomes then very difficult for customers to prioritize, because everybody is basically telling them that our technology can help you to solve your problem, even if we've never helped a similar company solve that problem in the past. So this is something I think as a collective we have to get better at in this domain of IoT, which is just very early. So companies are kind of figuring out where they want to focus right now.
I think, Eric, that's a fun question, because you've hit on kind of one of the perennial challenges for a startup. And there's a couple of things that experienced startup people probably know, is that you might have a technology that's horizontal, but and you can say, we could do oil and gas. Oh no, we could do municipalities and water. Oh yeah, we could do flood prevention and things like that. And you can easily say, oh, we could do all those things. And as a startup, you need to be nimble and you need to be able to say yes to any reasonable demand a customer has, because you need those early customers. So the flexibility, if you truly have a horizontal technology, you kind of want to say, yes, we can do all these different things. But the paradox is that as a startup, you cannot do biz dev that way. You can't go to every conference, like the automotive conference, the municipality conferences. You can't try to do biz dev with all these people, because the resource requirements for having biz dev staff and sales staff would be way too high. You blow all of your startup money trying to get the word out to all of these shotgun, scattershot different industries. You need to be more focused as a startup and spend fewer resources on biz dev. So the paradox is that while your technology, you want to be as broad as possible and you try to talk a broad story, as you actually get that whittled down to a sales message or a marketing message, you need to talk to a specific industry and you need to have a good message that resonates with that industry. And so you need to make sure you're actually having conversations with people in that industry. You do go to the conferences, you do meet with them, so that you can actually speak their language and make sure that you're addressing some of their real needs. So, as I said, that's why it's a paradox. A startup needs to be very flexible on technology and very focused on biz dev. And I think the way that happens is, you say these big and I wear many hats, they kind of need to wear many hats. And it might seem kind of like they're being fake at first, but this is the life of a startup. Make a technology can be broadly applicable and then say, no, we're just for the gas industry. We're all about the gas industry. You double down your biz dev on the gas industry and you try to get a beachhead in something and get some established clients. And then later in phase two, you go to different industries, because now you have the resources and you're growing up and you can actually use the gas industry success as a reference case. Plan B, of course, is you didn't make any sales in the gas industry. So maybe you go find another industry and you hope you have enough funding to last that. That often happens, right? But I think, as I said, people who are experienced in startup will know you can't do biz dev across the board. You got to focus on a certain customer case. So that, continuing on with that, so let's assume the startup is doing it right, has a broadly applicable technology, but has focused their biz dev message down to what they hope are the correct target audience. And they're focused on them and they're giving them time and they're spending resources getting the messaging right for that target audience. So once they pick that target audience, then they get back to what we talked about before, where they're going to build up a more complete solution. And this, again, this is why a startup can't do it across the board. By build up a complete solution, I mean, if you're back to making that one agricultural ground moisture sensor, and that's what you're trying to sell, and now you're talking to agricultural potential customers, cooperatives, agribusiness, and you're talking to say, I got a sensor. They're going to say, great, but that's not a solution. So you're going to, as a sensor maker, going to have to work across the board with other people that can integrate your sensors into their complete solutions. So maybe it is John Deere. So you're going to have a range of partners, and you're going to have to go to that end market with this suggested implementation plan. So yeah, we got great sensors for you. And if you choose to use our sensors, here are the additional vendors we recommend you work with. They put together a great solution with us. So you need to build up, you know, partners in that area of agribusiness, if that's the one you choose to focus on. This is no small feat. And this is the reason it's so complicated and so difficult for a startup to sell into this is because, as I said, way back, it's a complex web and IoT is new and there's a lot of education you have to do. And frankly, this is why when there's new waves of technology like IoT, there will be a lot of bodies left in the field. Like there will be a lot of dead startups because there's a lot of, you know, the slow education process right now because we're early in the game.
So this is advice for startups. If we look at the larger companies, you've explained, you know, their role in this in terms of identifying the right technology that's coming out of startups, being able to help those startups commercialize, develop this into solutions that are communicated to the end customer and help to ease that adoption. Can you give us an example of one company that you see doing a particularly good job at playing this role of surveying the technologies that are coming to market, integrating them into real solutions that are, you know, maybe not plug and play, but at least can be communicated to customers?
Yeah, Eric, I can, in fact. And I think, I'm just going to pick an example that is a horizontal solution, because frankly, that's the ones that you see most often, that I see most often. So I'm going to mention for AT&T, and they've got a device that is a sensor unit that's, of course, connected to the AT&T cellular network. It can roam around the world. And the idea is this sensor can measure temperature, vibrations, light, and a variety of things. So it has all this sensing capability built into it. It's kind of one-size-fits-all package. This is why it's horizontal. You could take this thing, you could slap it inside a shipping container. You could put it on an expensive piece of equipment, say a Caterpillar bulldozer or something like that. You could put it in a refrigeration truck and monitor the temperatures in there. And the idea is that you can buy this from AT&T. It comes with connectivity. It comes with all those sensors. AT&T provides you some preferred partners in terms of the analytics. So you can track your vehicles as they're driving around with these refrigerated units. You can track the temperature. You can have alarm situations put into the software. So AT&T is coming at you with kind of a complete solution. That little hardware bundle they've got is enclosed. It's already got the radio from a radio provider. For example, it could be Ericsson or somebody else. It's got the sensors from a variety of sensor providers and probably a circuit board as well that they've probably assembled through a partner. So they put together a whole lot of partnerships already in the hardware. They add their connectivity as a service, and then they recommend the analytics and cloud layer on top of that and have a variety of people you can choose from so that you can kind of go to them and pick a complete solution if your needs are horizontal, right? And that's great. Now, I know this podcast is being sponsored by GE, so they're a great example to bring up as well. But this is going to be a much more verticalized solution that is less familiar to people because these vertical things are usually, this is kind of inside baseball for the industries at play. But if you look at something as complicated as a jet engine, the maintenance on those is very important, obviously. We don't want to have them die in flight. And it's also very expensive. And just because of the nature of a jet engine, the way it's constructed, it's very deep and there's a lot going on behind a series of blades. So to actually work on the interior of the engine is pretty expensive. So what you can do with an IoT solution is you could put a series of sensors inside the engine that can sense different failure conditions and prevent them from occurring or sense them before they occur. And then you can also, you have to get those sensors provided from by a sensor maker, right? And you integrate them into the engine, which could be a GE engine. And then you need to provide a service on top of that that airlines can use to monitor the condition of their engine. So you can do that as a service to the airlines. And of course, ultimately, this serves the general flying public and gives us cheaper airfares and a higher level of safety at the same time. Pretty strong benefits by monitoring the internals of the engine. So you can get these very verticalized solutions that would not maybe be a national story. And you wouldn't see them at every AT&T retail store. And you get those great horizontal solutions that the average person could walk into a store and go, hey, what's this little box? And, oh, that's something we've got for IoT. You know, the store could tell you. And you think, yeah, that might actually apply. I mean, I run a locksmith and I got four trucks in town. I'd like to monitor where they are. That's a simple solution. Bang, I'll put that on there. Interestingly, I asked, hey, what's the light sensor for? Like, what do people need to do for monitoring light inside a container? Thinking, are there plants going in there? And the answer is actually interesting. It's, well, there's a lot of shrinkage during shipping, right? So if you put a shipping container from Shanghai to where you are, Shenzhen to New York City. It goes across the ocean and it hits the port, let's say Los Angeles, Long Beach, and then gets thrown on a train or a truck, trucked across the country, New York. There's a number of opportunities for somebody to tamper with the shipment and take something out of it. You know, a couple of laptop computers or air conditioners fill out the back of the container. The light sensor is mostly for knowing when the doors were open. So if you're worried about shrinkage, you know, first of all, you know through the tracking where your container is. You know if it's had severe vibrations, so that if a bunch of your air conditioners inside are broken, you might be able to bill it back to the shipping company saying, what happened Sunday at 10:15 a.m.? Seems like my container was dropped. But importantly, if the door is open, you know when. Now, let's say you take those vibrations and you just kind of record those into a log. If the air conditioners come out of the box just fine in New York City, you don't care that the vibration occurred. If they're broken, you might use that log. But the light is a little different. Let's say that when you close container doors in Shenzhen, you activate an alert that says, if you sense light, notify us immediately. So that, 2 weeks later, that container is in a truck rolling through Utah, that's why in New York City, stop for unusually long amount of time, and the light sensor indicates there's light inside the container. You might be able to immediately react and call police and say, hey, I can go have a look at this, or call one of your agents and immediately contact the trucker and go, either you or somebody else has opened that truck. So could you please verify that nothing is missing? So you can immediately react to that shrinkage problem through an alert. So there's all kinds of things you can do with that horizontal sensor solution. Pretty neat.
Cool. Thanks. Great examples. The GE one, I think, in particular, a great illustration of your point of the need to focus, because if you're this sensor manufacturer that wants to sell into a jet engine and you believe you have a horizontal technology, you've got to be 100% focused on the aerospace industry, or GE is not going to have the confidence in you to bring you on as a supplier, even if it's applicable to other areas.
We see a lot of that, what you just said. We see a lot in the automotive industry where people make some really good sensors or consumer electronics and say, oh, we could put this inside of a car. But the requirements for an automobile are, you know, everybody wonders, why does this car stereo cost, $2,000 when I can buy the same thing, or I could slap an iPod in my car for so much less? And the reason is, you cycle that iPod or iPhone out every 2 years, but hardware that goes into cars needs to be able to last at least 11 years or more. It needs to be able to function in temperatures ranging from minus 40 Fahrenheit or minus 40 Celsius, all the way up to, 150 Fahrenheit. So the tolerances and the vibration resistance are huge. So yeah, you need to be focused on an industry to give them specifically what they need.
Last question, make versus buy. So you've created ecosystems in Shanghai. We've also created ecosystems. Large companies sometimes make the decision to start a consortium around a particular technology, or to fund the foundation of an industry consortium. Many other companies prefer not to start their own or participate in the founding of a new organization, but they'll participate as members in multiple. How do you view the basic make versus buy decision around an ecosystem? When does it make sense to craft your own, and when does it make sense to spread your resources and participate in multiple?
I think there are times when it makes your sense. In general, I like open ecosystems, and I find that if you look long-term, they're often the ones that have the most success. So Windows versus Apple as an example, and of course, it's not the only one. But there are examples where trying to shoot the moon, basically, trying to run the entire ecosystem yourself pays off, and the iPhone, Windows versus Apple is one example, and then iPhone versus Android is a different one, right? Where Android definitely wins the shipping numbers contest over iPhone. iPhone wins the profit numbers. So it's very profitable for them to run vertically. So here are the things you need to see if you want to run vertically and try to provide the entire solution. First of all, you need to be well-capitalized big business, because a startup just can't come out and do a vertical solution with any kind of credibility. We talk about how you have to focus to get your resources, and you can't do every step of a vertical solution and provide the supply chain yourself. If you're a sensor company, you can't go out and build the enclosure, then build the radio, then build, you got to have partners. You're not going to build a network and be a network operator that provides the connectivity, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to be super large if you want to shoot the moon, so to speak. And then the other thing is you have to have a credible play, like where people can identify your brand and it makes sense in that space. That really helps a lot. If you're John Deere, for example, you might have some good credibility if you wanted to build a vertical solution for the agricultural industry. If you are Immersion Technologies, who provide haptic sensors for phones and do a great job at that. Well, if you want to say, hey, we got a great haptic sensor for some agri thing, we want to go shoot the moon, people will go, yeah, I don't see you as a strong player in the agribusiness space. That's not really a credible play. So you got to have credibility. So I'm up to two, capital, then credibility. And the next thing is you have to have competent solutions across that whole range. You can't have, you might have the best sensors. You have to have a competent solution in terms of connectivity, in terms of analytics and things, if you want to provide the vertical thing. It doesn't have to be best at every step, but it has to be competent. It can't be bad. And that's where, you know, things usually fall apart, because customers go, why are you locking me into your crappy analytics platform when there's much better ones available? I love your sensor, but I'm not going to buy it because you're locking me down. That's where you start losing it if you can't be competent on every level. So capitalize, competent on every level. And then the third thing is, I would say early ecosystem. So if it's early in the ecosystem, sometimes it's good to provide the vertical solution, because education becomes easier. And remember back to that story I told you about the plumber who's actually a private equity guy who was buying plumbers up, didn't know where to start. Well, if you can go with one turnkey solution, say, listen, you don't know where to start, I can give you turnkey, start to finish, total solution from one vendor, throat to choke if you have problems, that customer is going to like that. So early in the ecosystem is a good time to try to shoot the moon. So basically, in the IoT, industrial IoT and home and everything, we are early ecosystem. So a lot of people are tempted to try to shoot the moon because of that early element. The question is, do they have the other two things I talked about, credibility in the space and adequate capital and competence across all things. In fact, it looks like I got some C's. I can make 4 C's. Credibility, competence, capital, and I don't know, early ecosystem. Well, I got 3 C's and an E. I guess I have to work on that before I write my book.
No, it's a good point, but very, very few then companies can meet these criteria, right? Even on the competence level, I guess we've seen a lot of the companies that have been traditionally quite vertically oriented around electrical and mechanical engineering solutions. Now they're finding that there's this big competence gap in analytics, IT, connectivity, which are areas that they didn't have to deal with previously in their vertical solution.
Yeah, and it's the history repeating itself. So one of the biggest, in the high-tech world, one of the most well-known stories is the Route 128 Massachusetts versus Silicon Valley battle. And the way Boston companies made computers back in the mainframe days, Tandem Computer and DEC and things like that, is they fully integrated. They made their own computers, silicon for the processors, all the way down to the keyboards were made by the company. And they made you buy their keyboard, had a specific plug, etc. And that was great because early in the ecosystem. But as the ecosystem developed and flourished, grew, people started going to best-of-breed solutions and integrated solutions that were based on open standards, like a PS2 port for a keyboard. Great, now I can buy a cheaper keyboard than the one DEC was trying to sell me. So the Route 128 model lost out to the Silicon Valley model of get your processor from Intel, get your box from Dell, get your cooling fan from somebody else, et cetera, et cetera. So that open ecosystem is long-term is usually the way things go, unless somebody manages to truly lock it down well. So if you look back in, we're talking IoT and we're talking industrial IoT, but let's talk briefly, smart home and home IoT stuff. You look at a lot of players right now trying to jump and be the dominant player in that space. And most obvious ones are Amazon through Alexa, Google with Google Home product, and anyone else who's kind of trying to jump in and play in that space as well, and a little bit behind those leading two. But these people have got the notion of, hey, you know what? A best way is to get out there quickly and offer a pretty comprehensive solution. But you'll find that even those guys like Amazon, who's a pretty, do they have credibility? Do they have capital? Yes and yes. They're trying to be very open as well. Like, we want Alexa to be the front end that people integrate and work with to work with their smart home, tell Alexa to open the doors, tell Alexa to turn on the lights. But they want to be very compatible and open so that it can turn on lights from Lutron, lights from Levitron, and a bunch of other providers all at the same time. So even players like that are saying, okay, well, we're going to do what we do and then make open APIs and partner with other people. And what you'll find is that's a smart way of building it. And those companies have said, where is the real profit and value? And they're saying, hey, it's at the front end that interacts first with the consumer. So if we just do that really well, we can be open and let other people bring the other parts of the solution and share ecosystem revenue with them. But I mean, we might be at the more profitable side of that equation. That's what's going on in the smart home right now.
That's a great point to round us up here. Last question, very quick. What is one company that you've seen in the past 12 months in the IoT space that you'd like to put a spotlight on that you think is doing great things, but people might not know what they're bringing to market?
It's okay. I got an example that I love. I got like a startup crush on this company called Sutro.ai. And I got no interest in them, and I can't explain it. That's why it's a crush. It's I do like their products. So I'll tell you a little bit about it. And if you're a pool owner, this will make sense to you. Otherwise, it may not seem too good. But so it's a device you throw into your pool, and it bobs around like chlorine dispensers often do. But what it's actually doing is, on a periodic basis, it's measuring your water and doing the same thing that pool owners do, where they basically pour drops of solution in and measure the colors that come up to determine the pH level of water, the alkalinity in their water, and the chlorine levels in their water. So this device does it in periodically, as I said, as it floats around in your pool. And then it uploads those either, and it's a startup, so they're not fully fleshed yet, but they're either going to work with Sigfox for longer range connectivity, so it can reach pools in backyard, or they might provide a Wi-Fi solution, which sometimes has trouble reaching the backyard pool. So it's going to upload those to a cloud, and the cloud is going to be able to tell you how to manage your pool. And the reason I have a crush on that company is because I currently waste a lot of time and money forgetting about my pool, and then remembering it, putting in too much chemicals. And you know, they say, oh, you're supposed to put in a bit of chemicals. Don't put it all in at once. I don't want to keep coming back to my pool five times. So I just throw it all in at once. And a lot of pool owners do this. And then you put in too many chemicals. And so by having a smart connected pool, basically having the water in your pool connected to the internet and the cloud, and having an AI service by Sutro monitor that water. And by the way, it knows the capacity of my pool. It knows what's in my water through some early, initial measurements and such. I'm going to get text messages say, hey, Derek, looks like your pH levels are a little high. Put in 3/4 of a cup of this chemical and you should be good. So it's going to give me precise measurements, tell me how much to do, and also tell me when to do these things. So I'm going to kind of be able to forget and just get alerts on my phone that say, put this in now. So I'm going to be putting in fewer chemicals at the right time, probably even after I pay them, saving money. To me, that's the great kind of solution, where it makes my life easier and saves me money and pays for itself. So I like that company a lot. And other thing that's cool about them is they're using their sensor. They're basically the chemical sensing technology they developed, also in some agricultural endeavors and stuff. So they're active in both pool and spa and agri business. So cool startup to look for, sutro.ai.
Cool. Love it. Derek, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
My pleasure. It's been great.
How can people get in touch with you or learn more about what you're doing?
Sure. Well, one of the best ways to get in touch with us is to just look at our website. So Silicon Valley IoT Forum. And if you're interested in the stuff we're doing on telecom side, telecomcouncil.com and also autotechcouncil.com for the auto stuff. And I'm on Twitter at Derek Curtin.
All right. Have a great day, Derek.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thanks for tuning in to another edition of the Industrial IoT Spotlight. Don't forget to follow us on Twitter at IoT1HQ and to check out our database of case studies on IoT1.com. If you have unique insight or a project deployment story to share, we'd love to feature you on a future edition. Write us at eric.walenza@IoT1.com.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of the Ventures in Industrial IoT series. You can learn how GE Ventures goes beyond funding to support their partners in technology development and commercialization at www.geventures.com.